Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Jill Robbins and Alice Bryant. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Pakistan called a meeting with the United States ambassador in Islamabad Tuesday. The talks came one day after U.S. President Donald Trump criticized Pakistan for continuing to provide shelter for terrorists. He was speaking about militants who are fighting U.S. forces in nearby Afghanistan. The president's comments about Pakistan appeared on the Twitter online messaging service. In his first tweet of 2018, Trump said the U.S. government has foolishly given Pakistan over $33 billion in aid over the past 15 years. In return, he continued, the U.S. had gotten nothing but lies and deceit, thinking of our leaders as fools. Trump added, they give safe haven to the terrorists we hunt in Afghanistan with little help. No more. U.S. officials have long accused Pakistan of failing to deal with or of secretly helping the Afghan Taliban and the Haqqani network. The two groups have carried out cross-border attacks against Afghan and U.S.-led forces. Pakistan's government denies claims it is sheltering Afghan militants. The government says anti-state militants are using Afghanistan for terrorist attacks against Pakistan. On Monday, Pakistani Foreign Minister Khawaja Asif reacted to Trump's comments. The official wrote on Twitter that his country will let the world know the truth, difference between facts and fiction. Rafiq Dasani is with the RAND Corporation Research Group.
There's no doubt that Pakistan remains a safe haven in many areas for terrorist activity. I mean, compared to the last 2 years, things have changed dramatically for the better, but still not at the level where it should be.
Dasani told VOA that Asif wants the world to know that his country is in the front lines of the battle against terrorism. He said, Pakistanis believe they have paid dearly for problems that were created a long time ago without their consent. He was speaking about the 1979 invasion of Afghanistan by the former Soviet Union. Dasani said, Pakistanis feel aggrieved that what they have lost is so much more than any other country. He said that their failures have been recognized more than their sacrifices. President Trump announced his administration's policy on South Asia last August. At the time, he accused Pakistan of providing safe haven to terrorists. The administration also announced at the time that it was suspending $255 million in military assistance until Pakistan takes steps to fight extremists. Thank you.
Think of a language as a living thing. Like most things living, languages are always growing and changing. And today, in our highly connected world, these changes happen more and more quickly. Every year, for example, the Merriam-Webster English Dictionary adds many new words, or new meanings for common words, to the English language. English has always been made up of words from many languages. Most English words come from Latin, Germanic languages, and French. But in the last several hundred years, English has borrowed words and terms from other languages. These so-called borrowed words are not returned, of course. Rather, they remain part of a language for a very long time. You can learn a lot about history and culture by looking at what led to the borrowing of certain words. Today, we will tell you the story of words that English has borrowed from Japanese. It may surprise you that English has taken more than a dozen words from Japanese. They include skosh, honcho, tycoon, hunky-dory, and most recently, emoji.
Let's start with emoji. About 10 years ago, English speakers used the word emoticons for computer keyboard symbols that express emotion in electronic messages and on the internet. That was before the invention of smiley face icons. Then, in the late 1990s, a Japanese computer programmer named Shigetaku Kurita changed everything when he invented emoji, images, icons, and symbols that express meaning without words. In Japanese, the word emoji means pictograph and comes from the word e, meaning picture, and moji, meaning letter or character. The similarity to the English word emotion is only by chance. Another word English borrowed from Japanese is skosh. The English meaning of skosh is a small amount. The word is used informally in English. It comes from the Japanese word skoshi, which means the same thing. In Japanese, skoshi can also mean a few, a little, or some. Notice the similarity between the English and Japanese pronunciations, skosh and skoshi. American soldiers picked up skoshi while they were stationed in Japan after World War II. They brought it back with them to the United States in the 1950s. While the English word is a noun, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary notes that sometimes we also use the word as an adverb, such as in the example, I'm a skosh hungry. In other words, I'm a little bit hungry.
Honcho, another word borrowed from Japanese, also came into use around World War II. In English, honcho means person in charge. In Japanese, the word is hancho. It means squad leader and comes from two words, han, meaning squad, and cho, meaning head or chief. Imprisoned American servicemen in Japan learned about the word. Later, they brought it back with them to the United States. When native English speakers use the word honcho, they often say head honcho. It has the same meaning as honcho. However, it is a native English speaker mistake since head honcho is redundant. Another borrowed Japanese word that describes someone who holds a lot of power is tycoon. In English, the word refers to a very wealthy and powerful business person.
Tycoon comes from the Japanese taikun, meaning great lord or prince. The word comes from the Middle Chinese word taikyun. In the mid-1800s, the United States was ready to use military power to force Japan to reopen trade relations with the West. Navy officer Commodore Matthew Perry led the negotiations. When he arrived in Japan, he refused to meet with anyone other than the highest official in the empire. The Japanese presented Perry with their shogun, or general of the Japanese army. But they were concerned that the English translation of his title would not seem powerful enough to Perry. So, they introduced their shogun using the title Tycoon. What Perry or the West did not realize was that shoguns had more power than emperors in Japan at the time. Perry's negotiations with Japan were successful, and the word tycoon soon became popular in America. It came to mean top leader. Tycoon first appeared in print in the U.S. in 1857. Even Abraham Lincoln began to like the word. When he was president, members of his cabinet called him tycoon as a nickname.
Our final example today is hunky-dory. Today, this adjective means fine or free of trouble or problems. The word hunky-dory is actually a combination of words from two languages. The first part of the word, hunky, means in a safe position. Word experts say it is from the Dutch word honk, which means post or station. In the mid-1800s, hunk was a slang term that children in New York City used in street games, such as tag. In this game, one or more players chase after other players in an attempt to touch them with their hands. If the players reach the secure location before being tagged, they are considered safe. The story of the second part of the word, dory, is less clear. One theory from 1876 links the word hunky-dory to the Japanese word honcho-dori. This was believed to be a street in Japan where American sailors went to have fun while they were stationed there. However, clear evidence does not exist to prove this is true. What is clear, though, is that the pronunciation of the word for street in Japanese sounds a lot like dori. It's pronounced dori. Join us again soon to learn the history of English words borrowed from other languages. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to the Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. We have been talking about Thomas Jefferson's second term as president. Historian Joseph Ellis calls it a disaster, defined by the trade embargo and the looming War of 1812.
He leaves office in 1808, 1809, he really wants to get out of town and sort of lick his wounds.
In the months before he left office, Jefferson had signed a bill banning all trade with Europe. No ships could enter the United States, and no ships could leave. The purpose of the trade embargo was to keep America out of the war between Britain and France. But the embargo slowed the American economy. Many Americans opposed the trade ban. Jefferson's political opponents, the Federalists, used the issue to increase their strength in northeastern states. The year 1808 was, after all, a presidential election year. Thomas Jefferson had served 2 4-year terms as president. No law prevented him from running again, but Jefferson had decided years before that a president should be limited to 2 terms. Without such a limit, Jefferson believed, a powerful man might be able to keep the position for as long as he wished. George Washington had served 2 terms and then retired. Jefferson would do the same. Jefferson's Republican Party chose James Madison as its candidate for president. James Madison was Jefferson's Secretary of State. The party chose George Clinton as its candidate for vice president. The Federalist Party named the same candidates it had chosen 4 years earlier, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney for president and Rufus King for vice president. The Federalists felt sure they would win the election. They thought that Jefferson's embargo on trade had angered the people and turned them away from the Republican Party. Even some Republicans felt the election could go very badly for their party. But Jefferson remained calm. He believed that most Americans understood what he was trying to do with the embargo, and he believed they would vote for his party's candidate. Jefferson was right. Madison was elected. Thomas Jefferson left the White House in March of 1809. He believed the nation was in good hands with James Madison. He returned to Monticello, his country home in Virginia, and never went back to Washington again. Jefferson, who died in 1826, spent his retirement years following many of his interests. One was architecture. Jefferson continued building and remodeling his home, Monticello, throughout his presidency and retirement. The design was influenced by buildings he had seen in France and Britain. Monticello appears on one side of the American 5-cent coin, the nickel. Jefferson's face is on the other side. Jefferson also spent a good deal of his retirement writing letters. Historian Andrew O'Shaughnessy says Jefferson was one of the great letter writers of his time. One of his famous correspondences was with John Adams. Adams was the second president of the United States. Adams and Jefferson had been friends during the first years of the United States, but politics had made them enemies. Their friendship ended after the election of 1800. Yet, in retirement, the two men became friends again. Jefferson and Adams had what Andrew O'Shaughnessy calls a remarkable correspondence.
They discuss the memory of the American Revolution and the history of it and how it should be written, but they also range over scientific and philosophical subjects.
Jefferson wrote about 19,000 letters in his lifetime. A project to publish the entire collection started in 1943 and is not expected to be completed until 2026. Jefferson also used his retirement to improve education in his home state of Virginia. Jefferson believed firmly in the value of education. His whole idea of government depended on the ability of citizens to make intelligent decisions. He proposed a school system of three steps. The first would be elementary schools, where all children could learn reading, writing, arithmetic, and geography. These schools would be built in all areas of the state and would be paid for by the people living in each area. The second step would be colleges, equivalent to the high schools of today. He proposed that 9 of these schools be built in the state. Students would begin the study of science, or would study agriculture, or how to make things by hand. These schools would be paid for by the state. The third step would be a state university, the University of Virginia, where students of great ability could get the best education possible. The university would produce the lawyers, doctors, professors, scientists, and government leaders. Young men whose families had money would pay for their own educations. The state would pay the costs of a small number of bright students from poor families. Jefferson also proposed that the University of Virginia be built at Charlottesville, a town near his home. Many of Jefferson's ideas for the university buildings came from the architecture of ancient Greece and Rome. Jefferson drew plans for the buildings. The buildings were very well designed. Work began on the university immediately, but it was 6 years before the school was open to students. Jefferson was there almost every day, watching the workers. He was quick to criticize any mistake or work that was not well done. When he was sick and not able to go down to the university, he would watch the work through a telescope from a window of his home. The cost of the university kept growing, and Jefferson had to struggle to get the legislature to pay for it. He also worked hard to get the best possible professors to teach at the university. He sent men throughout the United States, and even someone to Europe, to find good teachers. Finally, in March 1825, the University of Virginia opened. Jefferson's health had suffered during his years of work on the university. He was 82 years old and feeling his age. He suffered from rheumatism and diabetes and was so weak he could walk only short distances. He knew he did not have much longer to live. He told a friend one day, "When I look back over the ranks of those with whom I have lived and loved, it is like looking over a field of battle, all fallen." As his health grew worse, Jefferson turned his thoughts to death. He wrote how he wished to be buried. He wanted a simple grave on the mountainside below his house. He drew a picture of the kind of memorial he wanted put at his grave. On this stone, he wanted the statement, "Here was buried Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of American Independence, of the Virginia Law for Religious Freedom, and father of the University of Virginia." Jefferson had been governor of Virginia, secretary of state, and president.
But historian Joseph Ellis says it makes sense that Jefferson would emphasize his contribution to the Declaration of Independence.
Those are the magic words of American history. There's 55 of them, and they begin, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." At the time that he wrote them, he didn't fully understand how important they were going to be. But they end up becoming the creed, the American creed. And that's his ticket to fame, the basis for his lustrous reputation.
But Joseph Ellis points out that Thomas Jefferson's reputation has suffered, especially among many historians. The reason, he says, is slavery. Jefferson owned over 150 slaves at Monticello.
He wanted to take the high moral ground and say that he knew slavery was at odds with the values of the American Revolution and the American Republic. A lot of people said that who were slave owners. But in the end, he says the federal government has no power whatsoever to do anything about it.
Joseph Ellis says Jefferson was against mixing of the races in society because he thought it would threaten the American Union. But he is believed to have had a relationship with a slave named Sally Hemings, who lived at Monticello. In 1998, genetic evidence supported the idea that Jefferson fathered children with her many years after his wife died. The historian says one reason people still find Jefferson interesting is the contradiction between his words in the Declaration of Independence and his personal actions.
He is the most resonant figure in American history because he simultaneously wrote the magic words about freedom and individual rights and equality, and at the same time was embedded in the great sin of American history, slavery and racism, so that he stands astride the great paradox that is the history of America.
On July 4, 1826, Americans began celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. But then, from Boston, came news that former President John Adams had died. His last words were, "Thomas Jefferson still lives." But Adams was wrong. At 10 minutes before 10 in the morning, on that same 4th of July, his friend Thomas Jefferson had died. Jefferson died at Monticello in his bed, surrounded by his family. As the news of the deaths of the two great men spread across the country, the celebrations turned to mourning and sorrow. Jefferson was buried the next day, as he had ordered, in a simple grave on the quiet mountainside. Thomas Jefferson continues to influence the United States, especially his words about freedom and democracy. And Jefferson's influence remained especially strong for James Madison. The fourth president had to deal with problems with Britain that Jefferson was not able to solve.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.